Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Stuart Onan, whose latest novel is titled City of Secrets. There are 15 previous novels. That's quite a few, including West of Sunset, which I spoke with you about, The Odds, Songs for the Missing, which I also spoke to you about. There are 4 books of nonfiction as well. Let's go back and talk a little bit about After West of Sunset, which deals with F. Scott Fitzgerald. This book deals with Jerusalem in 1945. What brought you to this subject?
Originally, it was a fascination with the bombing of the King David Hotel in July of 1946. That use of political violence, as someone who grew up during the 60s and 70s, revolution and the uses of political violence has always fascinated me, and whether they succeed or whether they fail.
Did you suddenly read about the bombing?
I'd known about the bombing for years and years, and knew it was sort of a watershed moment in 20th century, I guess we'll call it terrorism. And it just seemed fascinating to me that so many people involved with the Irgun, the revolutionary Israeli, I guess you'd call them a faction, had survived the death camps in Europe and immigrated illegally, as the British would say, and became part of this, what do we call it, revolutionary cell within a matter of months. Turned from the ultimate victims to a powerful force and trying to sort of grasp self-determination from the British. And it seemed such a turnaround. How does that happen and what does that do to somebody?
The Jews who got freed from the camps had nowhere to go.
And the British were trying to prevent them from coming to Palestine.
Well, where could they have gone otherwise?
Well, the U.S. wasn't taking them. Europe didn't want them back. So where are you supposed to go and what are you supposed to do?
So they snuck into Palestine.
They snuck into Palestine with the help of the underground that was already there. And once they came in, they were, as we call them, illegals. So they had to go underneath false names. They had false papers. And as part of that deal, they then did these little jobs for the underground. And everybody knew, you know, everybody in the community knew that these people were agents, in a way. At a very street level, they were agents. And it was a very grassroots kind of campaign. But at the same time, there were other factions involved. The Irgun itself, which was sort of a military outfit. And then the Stern Gang, which was just crazy terrorist, and the other two factions are like the Stern Gang. Let's stay away from them because they're making us look bad. And their idea was just to sow chaos and violence to convince the British that it just didn't pay to stay there.
Did you know about these different warring factions within the Jewish underground when you began working on?
Not at all. No, this complete discovery. In fact, these three groups were at war with each other. Back during the Second World War. It was only after the Second World War had finished that they decided, let's band together and take on the British as a unified force. And then it becomes very confusing morally, especially for the people that were with the Haganah, because they were there in a sort of, they thought, as a defensive group and a political group, whereas the Irgun and the Stern Gang were very much more offensive-minded. And so it was reminded me of Michael Harris saying in Dispatches, his great Vietnam book, he says, you're responsible not only for what you do, but for what you witness. And then to apply this retroactively to the people that had lived through the camps and felt responsible for what happened there as well, and then coming to this new situation, that seemed to me a really fascinating position to be in.
It sounds as if in order to do the book, write the book properly, you almost had to forget about every single year that came afterward and just focus on what was happening then.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't want to bring in our, our prejudices or our preconceptions from now to write something historical, because then you're just going to map the present onto the past. That's not what I wanted to do at all. I wanted to go back and start fresh with this character, Brand, and he has to find his way through, you know, this maze. He doesn't know what's real and what's not and who's on whose side. And so he's a bit lost, which makes sense because he's lost everything. He's lost his family. He's lost everybody he loved. He's lost his country. He's lost his identity. And he's starting as basically a free agent. And it seemed to me a really interesting person to start with in this country that's up for grabs. Here's a guy whose identity, his faith, the way he feels about everything is up for grabs. And that seemed to me really kind of dangerous and interesting.
It's also kind of a thriller, which is a little different for you.
I guess so. I guess. I mean, there are elements of the thriller in some of the earlier books. This seems to me to be a cousin of an earlier novel called A Prayer for the Dying. in which I look at a man in the midst of a diphtheria epidemic in a small town in Wisconsin back in 1873. And that question there was, how do you govern in a time of crisis and remain a good and moral person? In this case, how do you remain a good and moral person when you're trying to seize the power that you feel you and your people deserve?
Stuart Onan, so you've got this idea, you're going to write about this character. First of all, Brand is not a very Jewish name and not a very Lithuanian or Latvian name.
Weirdly enough, it is. In fact, in doing my research after I'd finished the book itself, I found that there was a historical character who came, I believe it was from Hungary, who was a main player in the Jewish underground named Brand. And I was like, oh, really? I thought I'd just kind of made it up.
Why'd you choose the name?
I'm not sure, but it came very, very early. I want to say within the first 2 or 3 weeks of my first draft, that seemed to be the right name for him. You know, of course, it may have overtones of, you know, firebrand or being branded. I don't know. It just seemed quite right for the character.
One thing I noticed about this and West of Sunset is that as we're reading, we have to pick up information. You're not really good on telling us backstory, and that's deliberate.
I let the reader catch up. I've always found that that's the best way. I always consider that the reader is as intelligent as I am or knows as much as I do, and that if they don't, they can catch up through context. So the context should always be there. I don't think anyone is really intimidated by this. And remember, Brand, being a greenhorn, is learning all this himself. So he is parsing it out for us as he goes.
And it also means that because Brand knows nothing and it's all from his point of view, the reader really doesn't know what anybody else is doing.
Right. We're stuck with his subjective point of view, that limited point of view, which is exactly as I want it, to be claustrophobic and to not know what's going on and to get that feeling of paranoia, the utter paranoia of not knowing even the people closest to you what their motives are.
And that includes his landlady.
Oh, yes. And landlady, the woman that he's sleeping with, the guy that he's taking orders from, the people that he's doing favors for, he's not sure exactly where he fits in or why. But he knows that this is what he's going to give himself to. This is his movement. This is his moment. And so he throws himself into it. And we don't think, as readers, we're like, I don't know. I don't know if you should be doing that, Brand. But this is the way he's going to regain himself and reclaim his sense of self.
Did you know what these people were doing?
I think I did. I think I did early on. I didn't know exactly how they were doing it and who was doing it and why. Exactly. But we get that sense as Brand goes through the midsection of the book that there's money and there's power and there's alliances involved that Brand doesn't know enough about. But he gets a sense of it. He's a smart guy. And so he becomes this detective figure where he says, I have this piece here. You know, I know this Rothschild. I'm following this Rothschild girl. And somehow she's tied to my contact, Asher, who is not who he says he is. He says he has this job, but he doesn't act like it. He knows that Eva is, by profession, an actress and a seductress. So he's got all these clues, but he just doesn't know how to pull them all together. And in that sense, he's very much like Philip Marlowe. And I use Chandler a lot in this book for the sense of mood and unease. And again, that paranoia that noir, you know, sort of feasts on.
The action takes place in Jerusalem in 45 to 46. You knew the key moment, which was the bombing of the hotel. Are there any other key moments in there that I might have missed that are already there historically?
When they hold up the train to get the payroll, that actually did happen. When they raid the British armory at the camp to get the weapons, that actually happened. Most of the things in the book are historical actualities, and Brand is sort of fit and woven into them.
You actually had a timeline that you had created from your research before you sat down and write the book.
Contemporaneously, you know, I got into the book and I got to a certain point and I said, oh, I better figure out how this all fits together. But I probably got 60 or 70 pages in and became fascinated with the Brand and said, okay, where does this go from here? How do we lead to that one moment there at the end where Brand understands where all this was leading?
And his backstory, did that evolve as you were writing it then?
Yeah, that came, again, mood, a book that is predicated on mood, again, like noir. And having a guy who's split in two, there is the past that got wiped away during the war, and then there's this new life that he's trying to form. Even his name changes there. His profession changes there. And in between, there's this time that he spent literally out at sea as a sailor on the Mediterranean. And so he's that split was really fun to work with in terms of where he came from and what is he allowed to hold on to. And a lot of the reading that I did about people that had survived the camps and then came to Israel, a lot of the people that were in Israel at the time, the people that were born there, the Sabras, were like, you have to put that away. You have to put your past away. We're no longer a defeated people. You know, we are a strong people. We are moving forward. And you have to grasp that and just put away all your sadness because it's not helping. And Brand wants to be able to do that, but of course, he can't. All he has is his past, even if it's all gone. He's always torn between the two, especially with Ava, who he's falling. He's falling hard for her. And, of course, he's lost his wife, Katya. So every time he's with Ava, Katya comes back in. And these mixed feelings that he has about the present and that survivor guilt, why didn't he die? Why was he the one that was going to survive? Of all the people that didn't deserve to live, he says, that was me. I didn't deserve it because I stood by and watched. And that's how I survived, by doing nothing.
Also, he doesn't know if Eva feels the same way because she lost her husband.
Right. He feels that there's simpatico in that sense. And when they're together, he feels that presence both of Katya, his wife, and of her husband, who Ava will not even name, will not even say his name to Brand.
They both have a sense of despair that they haven't been able to deal with yet because it's right after the war.
Yeah, it's all too new, and they fall in love. It seems they fall in love. I think it's a true romance in a way, and that's part of it. It's a very despairing love. It's a love that probably shouldn't be. Is it a love that's going to save them or a love that's going to destroy them? We're not sure. That's part of the romance of it.
Stuart Onan, Jerusalem, the outlines of the city. You have him driving a cab. Now, I assume you went there?
No. I looked at contemporary maps from 45 and 46 to see, you know, where Brand would be going, what were her natural fares going to be, which... typical then as now, you know, pick him up at the train station, take him down to Bethlehem. You know, you're dealing with a lot of religious tourists. And at the time, a lot of British, a lot of the British administration, a lot of British soldiers would go on little day trips out and follow little tour books. So I got some of the tour books from the time, put out the maps, and just figured, where is Brand as a taxi driver going to take people? Because that's his job, really, is to listen to what people say in his cab and then report it to his cell.
What was going on in Palestine during World War II?
In World War II, the Arabs, the Mufti, had sided with Hitler, which meant that the British were much more congenial, I think, to the Jewish population there. But during the Second World War, the Haganah and the Jewish Agency, which is a political arm behind them, decided that they would side with the British. That this war was so important that they would side with the British, even though the British in Palestine were their oppressors.
The British were also against Hitler. And,
right, yeah. Right. So it's, you know, your oppressor is also your protector. How do you deal with that? What happened was those factions that are now together after the war, during the war, they were separate. And it was a time called the hunting season. And in the hunting season, operatives from the Haganah would then inform on operatives from the Irgun and the Stern Gang. The British would then hunt them down and kill them.
And where was Begin?
Begin, at that time, I think he was still in Europe at that time. I don't know if he was there at that time. But then after the Second World War, once the war is over, then those three factions join together. And somehow, I don't know how, somehow put hunting season behind them. And the memories of hunting season, who informed on who there, which is, I think, a very difficult thing to do.
Begin is the only real character in your book, right?
The commander there of the British is real. I think there's a few other British people that are real in there as well.
And Begin was running Irgun?
Begin was running the Irgun then, yes. He was living in an apartment in Tel Aviv, and he would sort of sneak information and directions out to his troops using his wife's baby carriage.
And what was the relationship of Irgun and the Stern Gang, or didn't you get that far?
They were separate. They were split apart. I think the Irgun thought of themselves as much more serious and much more political and tactical, whereas the Stern Gang seemed to be out of control. They just seemed to be an agent of chaos.
So there were just a few people who were agents, and then you had all of these refugees like Brand coming in who were kind of just serving as their runners.
Runners, information gatherers, and people that could hide guns, because guns at the time were illegal. If you were with the Irgun and you were in possession of a gun, you could be executed because this gun could possibly be used against someone who worked for the mandate. So that the laws were really skewed against any kind of uprising, whether it was a Jewish uprising or an Arab uprising, because the British had sort of seen both of those things happen. There were Arab uprisings in the 30s that turned very violent there that the British crushed as well.
Let's suppose he didn't have a gun and he's arrested because they've gotten his name. What happens to him?
They would take his papers, and because there are fake papers, they would destroy them. He would be jailed, and then he would be deported.
They wouldn't necessarily know where he came from.
No.
Because he wouldn't tell them.
No, not at all. I don't know where he'd go if they expelled him. And where do they send refugees that you don't know where they're from? Or he could be simply jailed, and they had many jails that were set up around the country there. No matter what's happening, he is always at risk. But he's also protected by a lot of the people there.
How many people do you think in your research, Stuart Onan, how many people were in Brand's position in the period right after the war?
Oh, I have no idea. I have no idea. I mean, the British were very vigilant about trying to stop immigration into Palestine, especially coming from Eastern Europe. But people still managed to get in. The quota levels were very, very low during the war, and I think they were similar after as well. Legally, something like 5,000 to 10,000 per year.
History, of course, is written by the, quote, victors. Was it easy to find material that did not skew Israeli?
It was a little difficult in that sense. Most of the memoirs that I'm reading are people that had joined the underground, with the idea of a final triumph. And a lot of these books are written, of course, in hindsight, after the creation of the State of Israel. In the 1950s, it was almost like a little cottage industry, these memoirs there. And, of course, Begin's memoir is, any memoir, of course, is self-serving. But some of these seemed a little more than others. But to get some of the facts of everyday life and how the students say, used to hang out around Zion Square and the jazz clubs they used to go to, what the nightlife was like and the overall tenor of the times, that was really important for me to have.
How did you find that?
A lot of that I found through the public library. God bless the public library. I love them. And also abebooks.com, just going crazy with the keyword and seeing what popped up and finding stuff. Again, that contemporary stuff is really the most important. So finding things that were written in 1946, 47, 48, and up through the mid-50s, and then going to some of the great writers from Jerusalem. Obviously, Amos Oz, Aaron Appelfeld, coming from Eastern Europe and coming to Israel and people in Israel saying, okay, put that world behind you. You're in Israel now. And him saying, I can't. That's my life. That's who I am. And some of the earlier writers, of course. But yeah, it was hard finding sources that were not very pro-Israel. I did find a few Palestinian memoirs recalling that long, long time ago when the families had their house and they had all that sort of stuff. And a few British memoirs. And in a weird way, they're almost like American Vietnam narratives. Here is the army that was sent to do this job that was an impossible job to do. They put up with a lot of abuse. A lot of their friends were killed. And then they came home in shame, having lost the country that they were supposed to keep there. And they were kind of angry and bitter about it. So I saw a lot of those too.
One of the more surprising elements just in reading the book was Brand goes to a kibbutz, which resembles a concentration camp.
Yes. Yes, out in the middle of the desert. Yeah, yeah. Any place of captivity now reminds Brand of what he'd been through in the Russian and the German camps. And he goes out there and he sees these same loggers, these same barracks, these same towers, the same barbed wire, and he has this visceral reaction to it that he has to get out. He cannot stay here.
Was that kind of a serendipitous thing for you when you learned about them?
Yeah, very much so. And the role that they played in the resistance to the British, it was very, very important. A lot of their weapons caches were held there in the kibbutz and in very creative places.
The book is really about moral ambiguity, which is, I guess, on some level what the entire conflict there is about. That must have been running through your mind at every second.
Well, the means and the ends. How do you remain a good and moral person? And Brand asked himself this later in the book. He says, how do you call yourself a moral and good person after you kill people? And the flip side of that for Brand is, how do you call yourself a good person when you watch the people that you love die and being killed right in front of you? And he's had to bear both of these things. Where does he stand? How can he find a place in the world when both of those ways seem barred to him?
What I've noticed is that a lot of literature and film and television right now seems to be dealing with that issue. I don't know why. Do you have any theories about that? More specifically, why you were drawn to it, and then maybe we could expand outward.
Well, I think right now we're seeing this huge refugee crisis. And again, this refugee crisis now from the Middle East to Europe rather than that, vice versa. And the question of who takes these people in and what do they do. And then there's also that terrible fear that people like Donald Trump play on, which is the refugees are going to come and do terrible things to us, you know, because they're going to use political violence because they have no other voice in the world. And that has been at the forefront of our thinking at least since 2001. We're in that era. But it's human nature. There are revolutions all over the world. Right now, there are revolutions all over. There are revolutions starting. There are revolutions being put down. That's always going to be the case. We're in an age, I guess, if you want to talk about the last 150 years or so, where a lot of people think they have no other recourse than violence to state their case, to have their voice heard. A little bit of that came into play for me. But I'm much more interested not in sort of that bigger picture thing, but the smaller thing, which seems still huge to me, the one person. You know, what do you do as Brand? How do you live? How do you go on?
There's virtually no violence coming from the Arabs in City of Secrets. Does that mean that there wasn't, or that you just decided to put that aside to focus in on Brand?
Well, there's a little bit of that, but Brand hasn't seen it. And at one point, Ava has to point out to him in one of the revolts of the Arabs back in 1930s is that, you know, they came in and they killed us. And she says, we're not going to let that happen anymore. That's never going to happen again.
But it's not happening in 1946.
It's not happening there, I know, in 1945 or 46. No. The battle that has been joined here is between the British and the Jewish resistance, the Jewish underground. It is literally going to explode within a year of it. And that's because of those combined operations. That idea of putting the Stern Gang and the Irgun and the Haganah together with the Jewish agency behind them, bringing that united front up against the British, eventually, I think, ultimately drove them from Palestine and you know, paved the way for the creation of the State of Israel.
Stuart Onan, the irony of the terrorist organization in 1946 doing exactly what the Intifada did 50 years later. I mean, it must have been striking you on virtually every page.
I guess. I mean, I was trying to sort of just forget about the contemporary setting there. I mean, and because of, you know, having read, you know, all of the UN resolutions and the fact-finding missions by the U.S. and the British and all that in the Arab position, I guess, in the 30s and 40s and even after the 48 war, that comes later. That comes later, and that's a different, what's the word for it? That's a different act in the very, very long history. Tighten the focus. Narrow that focus to this one character in this one time, trying to find his way through this one place.
Stuart Onan, now that you've written kind of a thriller and moved in that direction, do you feel like you want to do it again? I mean, it's a kind of different type of writing. I mean, there are similarities in that you have to keep the reader reading and wondering what's happening on the next page. And to that degree, of course, West of Sunset does the same thing. But the element of danger is different.
Right, the peril, the immediate physical peril. Yeah, yeah. Not really, because the book I'm working on now is a very quiet book. It's a very pastoral book. This is a book about Emily's husband, Henry. I've written a book called Emily Alone a few years back about a woman in her late 70s living alone because her husband has passed years before. And I've written two books involving her and her family, around 1,000 pages total, and in them, Henry has been dead the whole time. Henry has not had a single word to be said. Not a single thought of Henry's has passed. So I thought, Henry kind of deserves his book. I haven't written his story yet. So I'm just slowly getting into his story. And he's in his mid-70s at the time that we meet him.
When you're doing that, does it mean going back to the other books, rereading them, and seeing what you had there? Do you have notes from those books which help you?
I do have notebooks from those books, and of course, the drafts themselves. But, you know, I have them sort of sitting to the side, but I haven't really gone back to them because I've been finding lots of new and other different stuff about Henry.
What year does it take place?
Right now it's 1998. So we're leading up to the millennium, and he's hoping to make it to the millennium. This is one of his goals, is to get there. He's an engineer, and he's always thought about the future. He's been involved with space travel and things like that. He's always been thinking about the future, and the worry for him is that he's not going to get there because his health is failing.
Well, what happened just a few years later, not only 2001 changed the political, or 2000 maybe, if you want to talk about that, changing the political climate, but within 2 to 3 years of 1998, the electronics revolution changed everything.
Yeah, yeah. And it's already beginning there, and he's sort of on the cutting edge of it, being an engineer. So he's already sort of tied into the Internet and very interested in things opening up that way. He's always a very forward-thinking guy, even though what I'm writing about sometimes is about his past and thinking about the past that is a very, very far gone past. He grew up in the 30s, so he still has memories of Pittsburgh back in the 30s when it was this huge steel powerhouse.
When writing a book like City of Secrets taking place in 46, Brand is not going to be up to date on anything and you don't have to really worry about it?
I mean, you miss those opportunities to use, you know, that level of communication, which can move the story very, very quickly. I'm really drawn to that era, I think. I mean, obviously the Fitzgerald book is 37 to 40.
Right.
This is 45, 46. The Circus Fire, a nonfiction book, is 1944. I have an early in a novel set during the summer of 1943 about World War II called A World Away. My favorite book. Of all of my books. I'm drawn back to that era. I love the music of that era. I love the films of that era. And I love the way that I'm interested in the way that the events of those, that very short period of time, created the world that I then grew up in. Now, I was born in 1961, and so I was born into the Cold War, and I was born into sort of, you know, a demilitarized Germany, a demilitarized Japan, the effect of the Marshall Plan.
The other thing about that era, of course, and even up to 1998, and I notice a lot of films and books are beginning to be set there, is that people were not in communication 24/7, which makes plotting a whole lot easier.
Well, in easier or more fraught, because your audience now says, oh, why don't they just pick up the cell phone, or why don't they do this, why don't they do that?
Well, there was an article I read about how in horror films, someone has to throw their cell phone out the window.
Or there's no service. Oh, there's no service. They have to say that within the first 5 minutes. Oh, there's no service.
Well, it reaches a point which, luckily, obviously, you know, West of Sunset is based on history, but even in City of Secrets, where you don't have to play those kinds of tricks.
I guess, but I would hope that I wouldn't play them anyway. I like folding in what's actually happening with people. In Wish You Were Here, which came out in, I think, 2000 or 2001, I had all the Game Boy stuff in there. And, yes, it dates badly. If you look back and you're like, oh, Game Boy, I remember the Game Boy, you know. But kids at that time were obsessed with their Game Boys there. It makes sense that certain characters nowadays would be obsessed with their phones or obsessed with texting or on Facebook all the damn time. I think in The Odds, which is contemporary, I work a lot with the Facebook and the wife being sort of addicted to it.
In City of Secrets, you have this one main character, Brand, and I know that I ask this question to everybody, and when I ask it about West of Sunset, you're dealing with real people, so it's a little different. Did he ever do anything, push you, you know, and I know what it is, it's like certain characters just can't do things at a certain point because you know them too well, and it's almost as if the character takes over. Did that happen in this book?
Oh, you mean a character surprising you by
yeah.
his actions there?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you always want to give the character the latitude to do what they're going to do, you know, as long as it's within their character. Does he do things that are out of his character? He would say so. When he picks up the machine gun for the very first time during the train robbery there, he acts in a way that shocks himself. And I think that's maybe a more important moment in the book than whether he surprises me. Does the character surprise himself? And then what does he do with that? What are the consequences of this unforeseen action? How does he view himself?
Did you always know the ending?
I think I knew the ending in terms of the event, how it would then affect Brand to the very last sentence of the book. I was unsure. And the question that we ask is, can we live with the actions that we do that we know are wrong? How do we make up for them? How do we redeem ourselves? And that question is put right into Brand's lap at that point, and then he has to answer it. So I didn't know exactly what his answer was going to be. The answer that comes at the end of the book was one of his choices. And the choices are not great at that point. I think that he's certainly grown into a man of some moral agency or moral action. I hope. I hope that's true for his sake. So where is there a place for him in the world now? Well, there either is none or the whole world is his, one or the other. It seemed to me very much a Conrad type right. ending. I go back to The Secret Agent, one of my favorite Conrad books, although he kind of slips the question of moral agency by giving the violent act of the anarchist group to someone of diminished capacity. In this case, Brand knows pretty much what he's doing. He knows the people that he's helping. He knows what could possibly happen.
Stuart Onan, you've got this book, you've got the new one you're working on. Any interest from Hollywood on City of Secrets?
Not yet, but we're showing it around. I think Ava is a very juicy role. She's many-sided. She's a many-sided woman.
Have you given thought to writing a screenplay for it?
No. For me, you know, just writing the book, dealing with material when it's still fresh, right, I wouldn't want to go back and try to sort of reconstruct it.
Have you thought about screenplay or playwriting then at all?
I've written some screenplays, but usually of other people's books as a way of sort of inhabiting the characters again. I wrote a screenplay of The Violent Barrett Away, Flannery O'Connor's second novel. I've written one of Going After Cacciato, Tim O'Brien's Vietnam book. It's a great, great book. It'll make a great movie. Dennis Johnson's Angels, John Edgar Wideman's The Lynchers, which I think would make an amazing movie, especially nowadays. But again, usually just to get a little further into the book and to have the pleasure of seeing what the author did with the scenes and with the dialogue and with the characters.
Any interest now on West of Sunset? Is that happening?
It sounds like it might. It sounds like it might. We've signed an option. James Ponsoldt, who did the David Foster Wallace movie, The End of the Tour, he is on board to direct it. I think he's a great choice. Yeah, it's a movie I'd really like to see.
You've been listening to an interview with Stuart Onan, whose latest novel is City of Secrets. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.